welcome everyone. How's everyone enjoying West Coast Socialism 2009 so far? My name is Jillian. I'm from Los Angeles. And I'd like to welcome you to this meeting. The title is Three Strikes, the Death Penalty, Tough on Crime, Is It Time to Abolish Prisons? So I'm very excited to be here at this meeting. And antes de empezar, ¿hay alguien que necesita traducción en español? No? Okay. So, very good. So, first of all, unfortunately, we've just found out that Barbara Becknell will not be able to be here for the meeting. But we have Crystal Bybee, who is a longtime activist with the campaign to end the death penalty, and she works with Barbara Becknell and is a good friend of death row inmate Kevin Cooper, and she's going to be talking about the importance of his case and the death penalty. And our other speaker is Cameron Sturdivant, who has been an activist with the campaign to end the death penalty for 10 years, and he's a main organizer of the Justice for Oscar Grant campaign in the East Bay. So I don't know who would like to go first, actually. So Cameron's going to go first, and they're both going to speak for about 15, 20 minutes, and then after the speakers, we'll have plenty of time for discussion, so I hope people keep questions, ideas, comments in mind. With that, Cameron.
Okay. I know that along with all of you, I'm disappointed Barbara was not able to make it. She's a tireless fighter in this cause, and that part of that is sometimes you just get a limit, and that's where you go, and that's where it stops, and then your body says that's enough. So that's why she sent her sincere apologies for not being able to be with us today. And we know that we will be with her again in the future and so on. Again, I just want to extend her regrets for not being able to make it here, and we will miss her, and I along with you, am disappointed that we won't be able to hear her words on this important topic. I do want to start off basically by framing this. It's a big mouthful, like basically, should we abolish, is it time to abolish prisons? And I want to frame that, though, with three strikes, the death penalty, tough on crime, by really starting off with two basic thoughts. One is about the importance that racism plays in our criminal justice system and why countering racism is so important in the struggle against it. And the other part is the part that reforms play in that struggle and the work that we are trying to do to rebuild today. So with race and racism in mind, I think that it's obviously we first start off by recognizing that Barack Obama's election as the first black president in the United States, in my view, is a green light for us, a green flag for us to start organizing, for us to rebuild radical prison reform efforts. It is not the checkered flag that we have crossed the finish line and now somebody else can do all the work that we've achieved the goal. No, it's the green flag. His election is a green flag that signals that we are now at the starting point of rebuilding the movement for real justice in this country. At the same time, I do want to, because we are at the Socialist Conference, I also want to bring in what are some of the things that make socialists, what do we bring to this discussion as well? And that, I do want to talk for a moment about Rosa Luxemburg, who was and you might say, why Rosa Luxemburg in this discussion? She's a revolutionary who lived from 1871 until 1919, working in Poland and Russia. What does she have to do with this? But her writings on reform or revolution, I think, really are things that we bring forward into this movement to really understand what's going on. What she herself, working in some of the biggest working class parties in the world had ever seen, supported the struggle for social reforms as well as working in social revolutions, and she did both in Europe. And what she said is that legislative reform and revolution are not different methods of historic development. Legislative reform and revolution are different factors in the development of our class society. In other words, the fight for reforms are what make working class people ready to participate in the revolutions that we actually want to see and want to make happen. She did, however, add this thing to that look at reform or revolution. She said, it is It's contrary to history to represent the work for reforms as a long, drawn-out revolution and revolution as a condensed series of reforms that happen in a very short period of time. Social transformation and legislative reform do not differ according to their duration, but according to their content. And basically what she was saying there is that the people who fight for reform only for reform are necessarily limited to basically trying to tinker with the society that we have around us today without actually doing something that we as socialists, as revolutionaries, we actually want a transformation of society so that the very idea of prisons are done away with, so the very idea of police, law enforcement, and the way that they're practiced today are done away with. The short answer to the question of our talk today is yes, it's time for prisons to be abolished.
All right.
And it's through...
Good job.
Yep. Okay. And if you are on my Facebook friend list, you already knew that. I think it's through reform efforts like the Families Against California's Three Strikes Facts. It's through our work in the anti-death penalty movement that we fight for the social reforms, which lay the basis for building a movement that can actually say, we are going to transform society and get rid of prisons altogether. And I really do think that the tough on crime part of this, which has a long and sordid history in American politics, really gave rise to those two little twins, the two little twins I like to call Three Strikes and the Death Penalty. And I just want to kind of set the stage for where we're at right now. In the past 30 years, the United States has gone on an incarceration boom, which is unprecedented in world history. In 1980, the total number of people incarcerated in the U.S. was 500,000. Today, the numbers are actually greater than this last statistic. It's at 2.2 million. 4.8 million people are on probation or parole. And while we have less than 5% of the world's population, we have 25% of the people who are incarcerated in the world itself. And this in the country which bills itself as the freest country in the world. So free that we go other places to help them figure out how to be free. Which I think is kind of a snotty way, I guess, of making a dot connection between the war abroad and the war at home, which I think is important for us to recognize in this. And race is undeniable in how this gets played out. Latinos have an imprisonment rate twice that of the national average. For blacks, it is four times the national average, with over 1 million African-American men in prison or in jail. Or probation or parole. In 2002, 10.4% of black males between the ages of 25 and 29 were imprisoned, and the numbers have not improved since then. The crisis in California is astronomical. The state had fewer than 20,000 prisoners up until 1977. 30 years later, we have 173,000. Between 1980 and 2005, California added 21 prisons to its roster. We spend $35,000 a year for every prisoner, compared to $7,000 per K-12 student. And really, I think this is really the next thing I'm going to talk about really has to do more with the ideology behind this incarceration boom, because it doesn't have anything to do really with the level of crime. Crime has remained, the crime rates have remained relatively stable since the mid-1970s, with the notable exception of homicide rates. Our crime rates are comparable to other industrialized countries. They're really not that far out of whack for any of these other countries. It really has a lot more to do with the ideological need of our ruling class, and I'm going to come to that in a minute, to control people in our society, and not just because they're evil, but because we live in one of the most unequal and unfairly divided societies in the world. The rich have only gotten richer, the poor have gotten poorer, and when that is the case, you have to have law enforcement and incarceration to make sure that the have-nots do not get out of control. As I said, conservative politicians began making crime a major political issue. Basically, in Nixon's administration, Haldeman said in a meeting with Nixon, you know, really, blacks are the problem, but the civil rights movement has made it now where we have to say, We have to recognize that without actually saying it. And thus was born the war on crime. It's a code word for actually racist policies which seek to incarcerate people of color at much higher rates than anybody else. I'll come to Jerry Brown in a minute. I mean, there's some stuff already about Jerry Brown in 1977 when he was governor, but I'll come back to that. And then there's three strikes, which is, as everybody knows, is a way that you, and these laws are actually in some ways not new. There have been persistent violator laws even since the 1890s in some states. But it was not until Washington State in 1993 passed their three strikes, and then in 1994 when California passed its notoriously punitive Proposition 184, that three strikes really meant that you were, whatever your third felony conviction was, you were going to go for a de facto life sentence to California State Prison. That concept, although no other state really has taken it as far as California, 26 other states now have three strikes laws. This is, one of the big things that we have to fight against. Now, I just want to say that the movements against these kinds of developments are still very small, but I think that there are important political changes which have occurred which make it possible to start talking about, well, not just, we've been, for 10 years we've been working the campaign to end the death penalty, but So I do think, for example, the victories that we had around stopping the execution of Kevin Cooper, which Crystal will talk more about, but in February of 2004, we were able to stop his execution literally at the ninth hour, but she will update you on what's going on there and why activism mattered then and why activism will matter today in that case. Barack Obama's election is just, I think, the biggest indicator of that changed political environment, which does inspire hope in people in the movements that we work in. I have never, in the years that I've worked in this movement, through the Oscar Grant work, I've never seen as many people of color getting involved, playing leadership roles, and actually standing up and leading this fight. And I think a large part of that is because Barack Obama was elected. Not because, again, we should place all of our faith just in him, but it has changed the environment that we work in. The result of that, just briefly, is that Johannes Messerly was charged with, they had to drag his ass back from Nevada, but they did charge him with murder. He was held on $3 million bail. He's out today, but he has that hanging over his head, and his preliminary hearing did end in the judge saying, you will be charged with murder. That is historic in California for an on-duty police officer. For an on-duty police officer to shoot and kill an unarmed black man without video, and it isn't just the videotape. The videotape is extremely important, don't get me wrong. But it's also, I think, the changed political environment, because there have been, quite frankly, videotapes of other innocent black men being killed or beaten by the police that did not result in the kinds of things that we're seeing today. So I just want to talk for a minute about why our prisons so important to the ruling class. And first of all, just who is the ruling class? It's that very small minority of people at the top of society. You can judge them based on how much money they make, and it's more money than anybody in this room. In fact, it's more money than all of us combined in this room would make. So it isn't the routine white-collar worker. It's not the mid-level manager in some corporation. We're talking about the owners of capital in this country, which is like 1%, 1.5% of the population. For them, prisons and punishment are first and foremost important for ideological reasons. First, for enforcing racism, which was an idea developed in other places, but in this country primarily to justify slavery, which is how this country's wealth was built in the first place. You had to have an ideology that explained why it was okay to do this to some people, but not to other people. And race was used as one of the main things to do that. It is to control. There's a large amount of unemployment in our society. There are large numbers of people who have no real hope of ever getting a real job here. And it is in part to control and to put fear and terror into those people that we have the aggressive law enforcement that we have today. There's also the safety of the institution, and anybody who there's, and I know there are some people in here besides me who visited San Quentin. Every freaky rule that they make up for why you have to like wear certain colors, act certain ways, go a certain, is all these rules are just the safety of the institution. And once they say that, there is no arguing with why you can't wear pink or why you have to wear brown or et cetera, et cetera. But we see, and the reason I say that or bring this up though is because since 9/11, the safety of the institution, which we used to see primarily in prisons and in jails, now extends to airports. When, if anybody was in the Clarence Thomas section with Sharon Smith on labor, he talked about the Transportation Security Act, where now longshoremen are being subjected to criminal background checks, and they have to go through all these checks to make sure that they are clean for working. And really, this is and these kinds of things are also imposed with impunity among workers who do not have documentation in this country as well. This kind of the same theory of terrorizing people applies to the undocumented as well. And I do think it's important for us just to recognize where do we stand with the current administration, because with the Texecutioner, a.k.a. George Bush, who had executed more than 150 people, you know, had personally signed their death warrants as governor of Texas, Barack Obama, when he was running for the Illinois Senate in 1996, said in a campaign questionnaire that he opposed capital punishment. By the time he ran for Senate in 2004, he was not advocating the abolition of the death penalty, but was saying that it should be investigated and modified so that flaws, like then-Governor George Ryan, when he commuted the death sentences and released over 120? I forget, but a very large number of death sentences were commuted automatically to life, or and with many of the several of those people being released. To today, where already Attorney General Eric Holder has authorized the federal prosecutors to seek the death penalty in at least four defendants' cases since Obama took office as president. And, you know, pretty notoriously, during last year's campaign, there was a 5-4 decision by the United States Supreme Court that held the death penalty to be unconstitutional in a child rape case, where Obama said, "I have said repeatedly that I think the death penalty should be applied in a very narrow circumstance for the most egregious crimes. I think that the rape of a small child, 6 or 8 years old, is a heinous crime, and if a state makes a decision under narrow, limited, well-defined circumstances that the death penalty is at least potentially applicable, that does not violate your constitutional rights." Now, again, I want to emphasize that I think his election signaled a big change among people that we are, you know, some people in this room, people that we've seen organizing in Oakland. I'm actually going to go for like 20 or 25. So
that's fine.
Yeah. That's how it's really set up. So it's because it's important to understand that, you know, we're both see the potential offered by the change in circumstances, but we also have to be clear about what his current positions are on this issue. For example, we also know that Arnold Schwarzenegger wants to restart executions as quickly as possible. But what about his Democratic opponents? And this is where I come back to, for example, Jerry Brown. Moonbeam of the 1977 era is gone. And we know that because, for example, he's prosecuting the SF-8. You can hear more about the San Francisco 8 case tomorrow when Richard Brown talks. You know, Jerry Brown took the initiative to restart that case again. He has been, as the Attorney General, upholding California's zealous search for and attempt to apply the death penalty. So since the Rose Byrd, she was the Supreme Court Justice who was most notably tied to the anti-death penalty posture of California during Brown's first administration. You know, he's definitely said goodbye to that period of his life and his new kind of role as like wanting to run for governor of the state of California. I want to come now to who benefits from prisons and parole, because I think that understanding who benefits is in large part central to the argument that I want to make about the centrality of race and activism to combating it. First of all, hopefully I've made a point that the ruling class benefits from the high rate of incarceration, both ideologically and primarily that way, but also because it helps politicians advance their careers. It's still pretty much the case that to advance your career as a mainstream politician in the United States, you must be tough on crime. Michael Dukakis is the most famous, and many of you may not even remember his name, but Michael Dukakis, who as governor of Massachusetts implemented a furlough program, the George Bush I was able to find somebody who, and in a totally racist way, find somebody who had committed a crime once they were released on furlough murder, and then Michael Dukakis sunk beneath the waves of tough on crime and was never heard from again. So politicians and the ruling class from an ideological point of view benefit. I would say, and this is the part maybe where it's controversial, and I hope that people will bring it up in the discussion, that prison guards and law enforcement unions, as well as the companies that build prisons or provide prison services, run a very distant third and fourth place in terms of who benefits from the current prison system that we have today. The reason why I think that may be controversial, and I'd like to have a discussion about it, is that it's very often put forward that it's just the companies that are making, it's just the people who are making money off of prison labor, and there are companies that are making money off of prison labor, but those companies in and of themselves are not actually able to make enough money to keep the California prison system, which is one of the largest in the country, out of the red, which is why Governor Schwarzenegger is talking about, if we don't have substantial changes in the state's budget, they may actually start to do early release of tens of thousands of prisoners. If those prisoners were really making so much money, and that was so central to the economy of the United States, they would not be laying them off by releasing them from prison. That is why, so I just want to say that I think those are third and fourth. I think the ideological reasons are the ones that are really important. Why is that important for when we're countering the tough on crime twins of three strikes and the death penalty? I think it's partly because we want to put race first and foremost in how we are organizing to fight this. We want to put racism at the heart of our argument about why we are opposed to this, as opposed to other organizations. And there is a real debate inside the death penalty movement. I don't know, Crystal, you may talk a little bit about the lethal injection hearings that just happened in Sacramento, where other organizations say, we can't talk about race. White people who are voters do not want to hear about that. They want to hear about cost. They want to hear about how much money we are going to save. First of all, the money that would be saved by changing the death penalty to life without possibility of parole, the biggest savings that occur there is because you cut out that pesky appellate process that is associated with the death penalty, because they know they make mistakes with it, so they give special appeals to death row inmates so that they don't kill innocent people or people who have not actually committed the crimes of which they are convicted, of which there are a lot. There have been five, at least, that I know of personally in California who have been released from death row as a result of this appellate process. So the cost savings come from leaving people to rot in prisons for the rest of their lives for crimes they may not have committed. And the other thing is that even if it costs $1 billion more, I'm not for incarcerating. Right now in California, 37% of death row inmates are white. Now, if you do the math, that means that like 50-some percent are people of color, far out of proportion to their representation in the general population. And study after study, which I will not bore you with, show that it has much more to do with your race as the alleged perpetrator and as the victim than it does if the situation is reversed. It also depends on what county in California you commit a crime in. That has much more to do with whether or not you're going to get the death sentence or a very tough sentence in general. And I also think that activism makes the most sense, but that doesn't mean we don't participate in understanding what legislative processes are going on, which is why a lot of us did go to Sacramento last week for the lethal injection hearings. Although what we said was, there's no right way to do the wrong thing.
Right.
You can tinker with the recipe all you want to, but there is no right way to do the wrong thing when it comes to lethal injection. We also do participate in policy meetings like those that led up to the but again, it's to put forward our ideas to pull that discussion to the left. We do, and I think finally, we want to make those connections. We don't want to be a narrow, little anti-death penalty or just an anti-three strikes organization. We've actually started making connections with some of the other major groups that are working on these issues. Because we do think, I think, that in the ISO, as socialists, and it's not just socialists, but we specifically put this forward, that we do see a connection between the healthcare system, in particular, the mental healthcare system, which even when you have private insurance, often does not cover mental health services. When you go to California and United States prisons, who will you find there? You will find people who desperately need mental health services. Yeah. Not because they're in prison, but because that's the only place that our society now puts people who have mental illness. Yeah. We think that there is a connection between jobs and unemployment and the desperate acts that people participate in to try to find some way to make ends meet in the lives that they are trying to live. Yeah. We think that there is a connection between education, for which we have a pathetic excuse of public education in the state of California and in most states in the country. And that is not because of the teachers who are working in those systems. It is because Prop 13 has gutted the funding. And it's because I would say there has been a systematic policy of saying that we want prisons first. We have 21 new ones. We want to fill them. We have a brand new juvenile justice lockup center in San Leandro. It must be filled. So education is deprioritized while prison building and prison incarceration has been prioritized. We think there's that same kind of relation between housing, and we think that even exists among food and nutrition. You know, people are basically starving for, a way to live in our society with dignity, with education, with opportunity. And we want to put those things first and not way in the back seat. And rather, pandering to like how much does it cost, and we can't talk about race. Actually, we want to talk, and I think if we're going to be successful, we want to talk about race first, race and racism first. Acknowledge it, put it out there, and also connect the dots. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Crystal to talk a little bit more about Kevin Cooper and maybe some of the lethal injection stuff.
Whatever you'd like. And again, I'll say again, I know Cameron said that, I know Barbara will be, very sad about missing this. She actually says that the Socialism Conference is one of her favorite places. She's spoken in Chicago a number of times. And, one thing that she loves is these kind of discussions where we can go beyond, our day-to-day activism and the fights that we're involved in and sort of, I think on a bigger picture of what do we want to achieve in the long run and what is it that we're fighting for. So I'll start with Cameron mentioned a couple times this hearing. There was a hearing in Sacramento on Tuesday that a number of us in this room went to that Barbara spoke at, and it was a public hearing on the lethal injection process, which luckily a lot of the speakers talked about how, it was impossible and we sort of refused to limit our comments just to the changes in the lethal injection protocol and how many light bulbs are in the death chamber and the sort of the words. I mean, they've really just changed around some words and some basic things about it, but it's killing people and it's wrong. So I actually want to start with, I read a statement by Kevin Cooper, and one of the things that the campaign to end the death penalty wanted to do there was to bring the voices of death row prisoners, bring family members, and really, just talk about how absolutely ridiculous this notion is that, we can just limit a discussion to how are we best going to kill people, because as Cameron said, our slogan is there's no right way to do the wrong thing. So Kevin's statement was called "It's Just Wrong," and I'm just going to read a few little sentences from it. He wrote, "In 1864, Abraham Lincoln declared, 'If slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong.' Today, in 2009, I, Kevin Cooper, a descendant of the slaves President Lincoln emancipated, and a 21st century imprisoned slave here in the state of California, declare, 'If the death penalty is not wrong, nothing in this life can ever be wrong.'" And I'll actually skip to, I have copies of it here if people want it, to the end. He says, "How many more people are going to be tortured and murdered before we end the death penalty? The death penalty is wrong, and that's just the way it is." So I want to talk a little bit about who Kevin Cooper is Can I do a quick show of hands of how many people have heard of Kevin Cooper before today, know a little bit about? Okay, that's good. Just want to know. So for those of you that don't, I'll say a little bit, and we have lots of materials here. And for those of you who do, I hope that you can learn a few new things. And again, I want to start with a few quotes to talk about who Kevin Cooper is. And I'm not going to tell you who I'm quoting for until the end. So if you know, don't say it. Let's see. This is a little bit about the history. So, you know, Kevin Cooper is an innocent man on death row. This is a little bit about how he wound up on death row, even though he didn't commit the crimes that he was convicted of, which was a set of murders in San Bernardino County. Once the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department investigators drew the conclusion that Kevin Cooper was the murderer, they manipulated and planted evidence in order to convict Cooper. In the course of their investigation, they discounted, disregarded, and discarded evidence pointing to other killers. Their decision to close their eyes early in the investigation to the possibility that someone other than Kevin Cooper might be guilty has led us to the situation in which we find ourselves today. Given the weakness of the evidence against Cooper, if the state had given Cooper's attorneys this exculpatory evidence, it is highly unlikely that Kevin Cooper would have been convicted. And finally, Kevin Cooper has been on death row for nearly half of his life. In my opinion, he is probably innocent of the crimes for which the state of California is about to execute him. So as much as that might sound like a fact sheet or a talking points that me or Cameron might have written, that was actually in a ruling by a set of Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals judges who wrote in a blistering 101-page dissent. So I'm not going to go into all the legal mumbo-jumbo, but the courts just once again ruled against Kevin Cooper and put him in a very bad legal position. But in total, 11 more voted against this bad ruling, but 11 justices signed on to these dissents, which, and they're these long, basically 101-page fact sheet of the kind of things that Kevin has been saying for years about his case, the kind of things that activists who've seen the truth in the case have been saying. And I skipped the best part, and the way this whole, this dissent, this legal document starts off is the judge, which was Fletcher, was the judge that wrote it. He wrote, "The state of California may be about to execute an innocent man." So we really think that right now is a key time to fight for Kevin, to fight against the death penalty, and then I think the things that Cameron talked about is how do we here today talk about these issues and link them to, I think, what's a bigger set of issues. We don't just want to say, you know, win justice for Kevin Cooper or even just abolish the death penalty, which I think we will do, but we want to do much more than that and take apart and dismantle and eventually abolish prisons. So I'll say a few more things about Kevin because I think that how he ended up in the situation he's in is very telling about the entire criminal justice system, and it's a story that, you know, anybody that does work with prisoners, death row or not, and works with family members and people caught up in the system, as you see over and over, it's the same story over and over and over. It's people who, you know, are not given opportunities. There's a lot of substance abuse problems. There's a lot of mental health problems. And then you have people who are just caught up. So, you know, if you're Kevin Cooper, you are in a minimum security prison doing a small amount of time for a nonviolent offense. You decide you don't like it there and you walk away, as he said, which they called escaping, but, you know, whatever. And you know, you go, set about to, you know, do whatever you can do and find a safe place to be. A horrible, horrible murder was committed, and Kevin was truly in the wrong place at the wrong time. He unfortunately was staying in a house right near or close to where the murders happened. So as the judge points out, from the very beginning, they found out, okay, we have this murder that's happened. This is in a very affluent white community. We people are calling for blood. Like, they want somebody, they need somebody to blame. And they said, here's this guy. He's African-American, he's poor, and he was nearby. So that's him, and they ignored every single bit of evidence, which there was mountains of, that actually multiple people committed the crime, and that Kevin had absolutely nothing to do with it. And I won't go through all the facts in the case, but just a few things to throw out there. And I think the thing that most people will remember about the case is that one person actually, it was a family that was killed, and one person was a young boy. He actually survived. And he was very badly wounded, but he survived this attack. And he told multiple people in different situations that it wasn't, you know, Kevin Cooper who we saw on TV, because they put his picture on TV and had a very large manhunt for him. And he, you know, said multiple times in multiple places that it was, you know, several different people that had killed his family, and that they were, he described them as looking more like white or possibly Hispanic, but definitely not Kevin Cooper. So that, I think, you know, I could go on. And we tried it, instead of a 101-page fact sheet, luckily we've broken it down to two for you. So we have those on the table if you want to get, you know, to know a little bit more about Kevin's case. And I think some of the things that are important about it, though, is that, you know, for us, and for me in particular, that the fight, you know, for Kevin isn't really just about this individual. But everything in this case, I think, shows what's wrong with the death penalty, with the criminal justice system, the fact that you do have innocent people, that this enormous bureaucratic criminal justice system makes mistakes left and right. Lots of innocent people have been, you know, later found innocent and let go. And then, I think, at lower levels, it's even more. I mean, the prisons are just 2.5 million people in prison, and many of them did absolutely nothing to get there, or had nonviolent drug offenses, which is we should have a whole other discussion about I think drug policy and how to change that. The absolute racism in Kevin Cooper's case, that I think that's the reason that he was ultimately framed for the murder, had everything to do with him being African American. And the outpouring of racism against him really showed that there were racist, basically lynch mobs at his hearings and trial. People calling, you know, for him to be hanged and lynched. And you know, there was no mistaking it to those people what this case was about. It wasn't about who killed these people that got killed. It was about making a symbol out of Kevin Cooper. And it's also about police and prosecution and the misconduct. And you see, you know, in Kevin's case, but in case after case after case of, you know, every level from, in Kevin's case, you know, the sheriffs and even, you know, the high-level people. Later it turns out they were all stealing the drugs from the evidence lockers, selling guns. Some of them were fired. I mean, it was just corruption from the top to the bottom, and the amounts of mishandling. And as the judge, you know, talks about the mishandling of and planting and all sorts of things with the evidence. So to kind of go on from like the stuff about who Kevin is to where we're at today, because like I said, I think that today is a really important moment for Kevin and for the fights and for the movement and civil rights. And I think that we just have this opportunity to bring everything together, the fight for justice for Oscar Grant. And I see Jack Bryson came in, so I'm hoping that he can talk more in the discussion about the fight for Oscar Grant. And I think that we want to link that with the fight against the death penalty and for justice. So with this ruling that I mentioned against Kevin, that was basically what that means for his case, is that he now goes to the Supreme Court. And so now his case will, and he's been here before, so he's out of sort of the appeals that he got to reopen after he was given a stay of execution in 2004. And so that's why the judge says the state of California may be about to execute an innocent man. However, we don't actually have anybody about to be executed, luckily, in this state because of the lethal injection issues that have stopped executions, which is why it's too bad Barbara's not here to talk to us about it. Largely, I think, because of the movement for Stanley Tookie Williams that drew attention and shined a spotlight on what happened to him. Out of that actually came the heightened debate around lethal injection, and that actually led to what we have, which is they can't execute anybody in California. So what's going to happen next? Well, I think that the state's going to work very hard to restart executions. Part of the reason they wanted to do this hearing in Sacramento was they want to tie up their lethal injection procedure. They built in secret, using prison labor, which is sickly ironic, they built in secret a new death chamber so they could show the judge at San Quentin, look, we have a new death chamber, we have a new protocol, we went through all these bureaucratic procedures, we had a public hearing, we took, you know, and they have to go through all of our comments, which is good because that will delay them, so there were like thousands of comments that they have to sift through and respond to. So they're going to go through all that, but ultimately, and Schwarzenegger said, you know, he wants to restart executions like yesterday. So I think that they're going to work very quickly to do that. And I think that Kevin Cooper, part of the reason that they ruled against his case, the Ninth Circuit has had it for a long time. They ruled against him in May because I think they want him at the top of that list of people that they want to execute. But he won't be alone. There's already, I believe, six people who are totally out of appeal. And by the time the lethal injection stuff works its way through the courts, it'll be appealed, it'll, you know, go on for a while. But once they get wrapped up, the state will say, we want to start executing again. And I don't know how many people they will have who are, there's over 650 people on death row at San Quentin. They are likely to have, I would say, anywhere, you know, it could be 6, it could be 12, it could be 20. It depends on how long it takes them to restart the execution process. And then I think it's going to be a very key moment for activists, all over California in terms of, are we going to be Texas? Are we going to execute, what, a person a week, two people on the same night? You know, what are we going to do here? Or are we going to be a state that actually gets rid of the death penalty once and for all? And how I kind of want to wrap up a little bit is on how we win, because I think it's very, I do think that we'll get rid of the death penalty. I think that by fighting for justice for Kevin Cooper and highlighting all of the issues in his case, that's just one component. It's also about building solidarity with the men and women on death row, involving their family members, educating the public about the facts of the death penalty. I think that we will get rid of it. But I think it matters absolutely how we win the fight against the death penalty, because as Cameron mentioned, there's a lot of debate and differences within the anti-death penalty organizations and movement. And I think that a lot of people have sort of given up on the idea that we're going to win about, that we're going to abolish the death penalty and also be able to talk about the things that we're talking about, prisons, three strikes, and all this. And they say, well, we're going to sort of give up on all that and we're going to say, look, it's going to be cheaper, we're going to save money, we're going to get rid of the death penalty. And you know what? It's okay, because we have life without the possibility of parole. So if you're out there and you're worried about crime on the streets, instead of trying to talk to you about the real issues of crime and where crime comes from, we're just going to tell you it's okay, because it's okay. We're going to take these horrible monsters and we're just going to lock them up in prison and never let them out. And I think that, and unfortunately, that's not really an exaggeration. That people really do say pretty much exactly that. And I think it's very important that we say we want to win the death penalty, but I don't want to end the death penalty and then in the process have strengthened this whole criminal injustice system, which I want to take down. That won't do us any favors. I'm not saying we'll get rid of everything at once. We're not going to abolish the death penalty, three strikes, prisons and the police all overnight. That's not going to happen. I think that, you know, the death penalty is going to be one of the first things that we can win that will go. But in the process, I hope that we weaken the whole criminal injustice system. I hope that by the time we're done, they're shaking in their boots a little bit, and that this movement will actually build links to and give confidence and inspiration to a whole new layer of movements around cases of police brutality, around three strikes, around just excessive sentences in general, around drug convictions rather than substance abuse treatment. So I think that it's very important, you know, for activists to take advantage of this moment and say, you know, I don't want to, we could just wait and see if they're going to restart executions, but I think it's important that we get as many hands on deck now, start building the movement, because it's, I think that I need water, that's my thing. I heard one of Kevin's attorneys talk once about death penalty cases, and he said it's like a train coming, you know, the train's coming, and when it's far away, it looks like it's moving very slowly, but by the time it comes upon you, it's moving very quickly, and if you don't move fast enough, it'll roll right over you. So I hope that people will ask more questions about Kevin, and if anybody wants to get involved, there's lots of ways that you can help in terms of building the campaign and the death penalty, fighting for justice for Kevin Cooper, and I hope that the discussion brings up lots of these questions about how we build the links and build the movement all together.
Cameron just wants to say something.
I was going to do something really unorthodox. I think that sometimes it's easy to take ourselves even for granted. And I did that today, so I hope you'll forgive me. Crystal literally stepped in to do this in 20 minutes.
Oh, wow.
So it's both a testament to her ability as an activist, because we're all volunteers. None of us get paid to do this work. So I want to again just acknowledge that Crystal brought her wealth of experience, her tireless work on this issue, shared it with you today. So please, just one, I just like to thank you.
Thank you both for those really informative presentations. That was amazing. And so I'm sure that, I hope that everybody would like to contribute to the discussion. I'm going to take a list. If you raise your hand and would like to speak, I'll write you down. Just wait one sec before raising your hand. And I'll just probably call on you by something you're wearing. And I want to get to as many people as possible in the discussion. So with that, please be conscious of how long you're talking. I'd like everybody to keep to 3 minutes or less. What I'm going to do is that I'm going to say try to wrap up when you have about 30 seconds left, and please finish your points, and then I'm going to say please wrap up, and at that point please stop so more people will get a chance to talk. It's nothing personal about what you're saying, but it allows everybody to be able to participate. And the speakers with all their experience and research will probably want to come in and answer some of the questions, perhaps. But we'd like to get a good discussion going on the floor, so please answer one another's questions as well. So with that, put up your hands again if you did earlier. And I will just nod my head once I've seen you, so hold on. You go ahead, and then everyone else keep your hand up. In the green shirt, yeah.
I wrote my stuff down because I had so many things I wanted to say, and I feel like I started trembling because I'm really, really passionate about this, because when I heard the statistic that 1 in 10 African-American adult males is in prison, it's like completely, how are we not outraged? Why are we not doing something about that? And I mean, I know it's a lot bigger than that, but that's just like such a glaring example, like it's just ridiculous. And prisons are so violent that the treatment that these people are subjugated to every day means that basically all of these people, so 1 in 10 African-Americans in this country, are being subjected to violence every single day for, if say they have 5 years, 365 times 5, I mean, it's just insane. So, here's stuff I was going to say. I like that the mental health connection was brought up, and I recently heard a talk. His first name is Chris, I can't remember his last name. He's not really an activist. He started a thing called Y Tribe, which is like this self-esteem building thing. This turned it into a commercial enterprise, but he didn't actually speak, but there was a video of him, and he has a learning disability, and he talks about the fact that prisons are filled with people with learning disabilities. And the concrete example that he gave was that he himself, being learning disabled, he had a really hard time learning math and reading, and still to this day has difficulty with those things. He was put in the back of the class with all the other people who needed to just think, who didn't know how to just think. Every single person in the back of the class, with the exception of himself, ended up in prison. And this focus on, you know, like the fact that we have the resources to work on prevention and to educate people instead of sending them to jail in the first place is something that really needs to be emphasized. I also have some concrete examples. The racism is really, really obvious. But, like, for example, I almost don't know anybody who doesn't smoke weed, right? And it's the same for everybody in this room. I'm actually not a smoker, but, I mean, almost everybody does, right? And, like, I know lots and lots of white kids. When I say kids, I mean, like, the 24s or 2, whatever. People who get, you know, whatever, they get intervention with law enforcement for whatever reason, they got a bag of weed, and the cops are like, come on, man, put that shit away. But if you're a black kid, and, you know, again, kid, I mean, it's a broad sense, you're going to jail, like, period. And I know concrete example, I've known people. We talked about, like, revolutionary versus reform regarding, you know, I'm a little bit uncomfortable, to be honest, with this idea of, or at least with the statement, we need to abolish prisons, because I feel like we're like, leaving out so many steps, because there's so many things, like, and then also I'm going to ask for the speakers or maybe someone in the room to address this, how do you address the contradiction between we're applauding the man, the police officer who murdered Oscar Grant, is going to be tried for murder, and that is a good thing, mm-hmm. but you guys see the contradiction, right? Like, he's going to end up in prison, and mm-hmm. we're applauding that, And I don't think I have a... Yeah, and so what I was going to propose is that what if, you know, I'm thinking of, there was an earlier talk today, and forgive me, I won't remember which one it is right now, but it'll come to me, but about actually, I think it was Jillian's talk. Like, you know, in these agrarian societies or hunter-gatherer societies, things were decided in an egalitarian fashion and democratically and so on and so forth. As a, like, possible reform step to dealing with the fact that, you know...
wrap up, please.
Okay. Do I need to stop now? Or do I have 30 seconds?
No, that's it.
Okay.
Sorry about that. Okay, let's see. Sam, over here? Go ahead.
Okay, I really appreciate, Cameron, that you pointed out that the way the ruling class benefits from the industrial complex goes far beyond the privatization of prisons. I just, you know, want to note that the prison industrial complex is much more efficient than old school slavery was. You know, back then, masters had to, like, house and feed. There's, like, now they get the taxpayers to pay for it. It's been brilliant, actually. But, and disturbances, of course. I think if we broaden the discussion of, like, how the ruling class benefits from racism, and what's great about prisons for the ruling class is not just that their populations are brought into them because of racism, but because they perpetuate racism. And they bring racism back into the communities from which they came. You know, it's a matter of life and death in prison. You have to join up with a racial gang or you will be victimized. And when the people are released and go back into their communities, those alliances remain. And so people are blinded to what they have in common. They're fearful of each other and the people in their own communities as opposed to those who are committing the real crimes in society. Crimes like war, crimes like poverty, crimes like racism and all that kind of thing. So I think that the role prisons play is huge, and when we start seeing the connection between the prison industrial complex and the struggle against it and other struggles like, I'm really glad you brought up services, you know, in terms of healthcare and mental health, you know, the people that are in prison are sick, they are poor, they need supportive services, and when you start connecting those kinds of issues, then you start seeing what the solutions are. You know, if we're going to abolish prisons, we have to replace them with something. And that's what you replace them with. You replace them with housing for people that need it. We have tons of empty houses along with foreclosures. It's madness that we don't have people living in them. People that end up in prison, that may be the safest place for them when they've been, you know, struggling with addiction and with their mental health issues on the street. That may be the only time in years that they've had health care right there in prison. So that's why it's no, you know, mystery why they end up there.
Start to wrap up.
Okay. And we can also connect prison, I encourage folks to, when they're talking with people about these issues, to make connections to the gay liberation movement as well. Follow the case of Alexis Giraldo, a former San Quentin inmate, a transgender woman, who is suing the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation to change the way transgenders are treated in prison. That's the big picture and connect these and the problems.
Absolutely. You in the gray jacket and then the woman in front here. Go ahead, sir.
I do volunteer work in San Quentin Prison. And I have an opportunity to talk to a lot of inmates on a very personal level. I have a few perceptions I have of them, and I want to address myself to two myths that are perpetrated by the establishment media. One of them is that everybody, especially the murderers of prisoner animals, I will say that most of them, or many of them, you wonder after a while why they're in prison. Mm-hmm. They have a sense of humor, they have feelings, they have the same thoughts as anybody else outside of the prison, and it's somewhat remarkable sometimes to think that some of these people are actually there for life. And the other one is that when you hear an inmate say that I'm innocent, they're trivialized by saying everybody in prison says they're innocent. And the fact is that they don't. The only one person I've ever asked said he was innocent, and in fact he was innocent. Everybody else who you ask about what they did will tell you, I was stupid, I was young, I did this, I did that, they may claim that they were treated unfairly, that they were overcharged, that there was something wrong with the proceedings, but they don't claim that they're innocent. That's just a mechanism to trivialize those people who are in fact innocent.
Thank you. After the person in front, in the purple, Rosa?
Rose.
Go ahead.
My name is Stefania. I'm from Olympia, Washington. I've had the opportunity to work with incarcerated youth, and so this is kind of a very interesting topic here. Especially when thinking about mental illness, I'm really glad that you brought that up because a lot of times it's not addressed. And also, it was very interesting to hear just the highlights of Kevin Cooper, how it parallels Troy Davis in his case. And so that is extremely interesting. My question is, how did the courts, in this state, handle death penalty cases in which those have been diagnosed with a mental illness? Now, I understand that they define mental illness by DSM-4, and so it can be anything from depression to anxiety. I guess I'm thinking specifically those who've been diagnosed with maybe personality disorders, schizophrenia, those folks who may not be able to grapple cause and effect, assuming that if they were guilty. Also, I'm reminded of Earl Washington Jr., who was someone with schizophrenia, who to appease, the police and just the media and everyone around him, pled guilty for a crime he didn't commit, spent 7 years in death row, was later exonerated. And so, again, the question is, how are the courts handling like folks like that,
right. Mm-hmm.
Keeping them off of death row?
Right. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And I have a really long list, so I'm going to actually ask people to try to keep to 2 minutes, or most folks won't get to talk. Okay, so the person in purple, and then I think you have white stripes, you'll be next.
So first, I just want to say thank you so much for the work that you do, and giving a voice and a voiceless. It's so important, especially at a time when media is shrinking and it's becoming so corporate. Speaking of corporate media, there's much to criticize newspapers for. I still subscribe to find out what's going on in my backyard, and because here I have some news for today. A judge can sentence an adult felon to life in prison under California's three strikes law because of past convictions in juvenile court where there are no jury trials. The state Supreme Court ruled yesterday, 6-1. So for those of you who live out of state, in 1994, the state of California passed this three strikes law that requires a sentence of 25 years to life if you're in three times. And isn't this, I read that some guy grabbed a woman's purse and slapped her, and that was one strike.
Mm-hmm.
So this is
stealing videotapes.
People are serving 25 years to life. So if you're 16 or 17 now, there's the guy who filed this case. He committed an aggravated assault in 99 when he was 16. In 2005, he pleaded no contest to being a felon in possession of a gun. He got 32 months. Now, if he has a gun again, he's going to jail for 25 years to life. That's what happened. This was yesterday. This came down. So my question is, this passed in 94. It passed the legislature, and then the voters approved it, the voters of California. Do you see a sea change if this comes back on the ballot? Now, I'm a journalist. I've interviewed a lot of Democrats who say that they oppose three strikes off the record, but they will not say it publicly because it's tough on crime. So do you have these conversations behind the scenes? What will change that? Also, I'd like to urge everybody to see a film called American Violet. It came out in theaters. Really good film, American Violet. And also, it's so important to support these groups, the Coalition for Women Prisoners. They take the children of prisoners to the facilities because they don't have cars, they can't afford the gas. And they do it twice a year. Some of these kids see their moms twice a year. So it's a really good organization to support Coalition for Women Homelessness.
Okay, thank you. So in addition to that question, there was a question about what would be the steps between here and abolishing prisons when we talk about that slogan. What is the role of prison labor and the for-profit prisons in the whole system? And a question about the death penalty and mental illness. So just to keep those in mind, and after you in the back, I'll have Dana. Go ahead. You're next.
Okay, I'm Wayne. I'm a public defender in Contra Costa County, and I live here in San Francisco. I'm very happy to hear what people are saying about this topic. It's so near and dear to my heart, though. It's just, it's very frustrating because there's just so much. So I'm just really kind of bullet points, going to kind of go through a lot of it. First of all, I think the death penalty really is kind of sui generis. You know, it's a very separate kind of thing. And most people that are in custody, almost 2 million people in the United States, nothing to do with the death penalty. And I think you have to use whatever argument you can, with all due respect, to get rid of the death penalty in the United States, because innocent people definitely have already been killed and will kill as long as we have the death penalty. So the wallet argument is not one I really like, but I think it works. I guess as a public defender, in some ways, I like being a capital case. I can spend $1 million on defense, whereas otherwise I don't get to spend that kind of money. So I'm not going to keep the death penalty for selfish reasons. Racism, what's going on? Oh my God, I work in Richmond. I can't believe what's going on over there. I think half of San Francisco doesn't even know that Contra Costa County exists. And there is, by the way, this place called Contra Costa County, and Chevron makes over, I don't know how many $1 billion a year. Right next to it is a pocket called North Richmond, which is one
where
of the worst places I've ever seen. Yeah, Pittsburgh, very poor. Antioch has one of the highest foreclosure rates in the nation. Who's organizing those people? Who's making connections? What am I doing? I don't know. I'm defending people. That's what I'm trying to do. Three strikes, it's as bad as you say, but it's not as bad as you say. It really depends on what county and what DA. Yeah, there are people doing 25 to life for stealing pizza. In my county, which is kind of in between, very rarely will anyone see actually 25 to life, even on a serious case. Judges don't like it, even conservative judges. Jurors don't like it. We have to actually do the blood here, but jurors, they don't like it on those cases.
Start to wrap up.
I'm trying. Okay. Abolishing prisons, I'm sorry, we're not even close. I love the idea. I see the humanity. Some of my murder clients are the best people I know. They're so wonderful to me. They care what's going on with my family, what's going on with me. But anyway, we're not there. I'm sorry. There really are some people that need to be locked up. And mental health is huge. At the AS, 25% of the people in county jails have mental health issues. I can confirm that. Very severe ones. Two other ones, the health issue. I mean, there's a receivership right now, right? So that's ridiculous. Guns and drugs. No one's mentioning abolishing or decriminalizing guns and drugs. I mean, most of the crimes are being committed. Most of the murders are taking place. I'm sorry. It's guns and drugs. It's a workplace, what have you. I'm sorry that it's, we're abolishing prison jail. What about Madoff 150 years? I thought that was pretty good. I thought Madoff. I like that. Anyway,
I got to go on to the next person. Thank you very much. Good points. Let's see. After Dana, the person next to me. Go ahead.
All right. So I'm going to pick up where you just left off the last speaker, because I think having someone like Johannes Mezzalou, who's a bar cop and murder cop for Grant, spend as much time in prison as possible actually makes our community safer. And I think that we can't be kind of like weirdly abstract about things. We have to say, what makes our community safer? Blocking cops who murder people makes our community safer. Where Johannes Mezzalou could get locked up, and it does matter what we do, and people should mark their calendars. October 13th, his court date starts. We have, one murder charge for him, but we're nowhere near the checkered flag that Cameron was talking about, and so people need to stay organized. So why is it that I'm not opposed to prisons in this abstract way? I actually want to lock up some people like George Bush and Johannes Mezzalou, because I see two systems of justice. And I'm fighting against the system of justice that exists right now for most ordinary people. There are two systems out there, and you cannot be fooled by it. There's a system that's applied to working class people in this country, and people who don't have money, and people of color, and then there's a system for cops, agents of the state, and for rich people. Yeah. And if you try to blend those together and say they're all one thing, it's not true. Yeah. You get a totally different trial. If you have money, or if you're a cop, then you do if you're an ordinary person. And those two systems of justice exist for a reason, because of all things that Cameron talked about why prisons exist. So I want to just say we are, though, in a historical moment, which is there's a massive economic crisis. So what's happening right now is, without us organizing actively in a huge way, they are coming up against the fact that they cannot afford the prison project anymore in California. They are so much in the red that it has become a question. Arnold Schwarzenegger is talking about releasing tens of thousands of people, not because he wants to, because financially he can't float his economy. He's issuing IOUs to people this week, right? So clearly there's an actual real contentious debate, but I think it's important how we fight. And I do actually think that, like, the question around lifestyle possibility parole, like, I don't want to win an end to the death penalty that means it's permanent incarceration, because for me that's a death sentence.
Yes.
Okay, but it's a less public, less appeal, and just as many innocent people are going to end up dying in prison, whether they're dying in the execution chamber or they're being brought out because they've spent their entire life in prison. And so I do actually think, sorry, I'll just end with this, which Crystal said, just how we fight and how we win. I want to fight in the death penalty, and I think we can in our very near future in the death penalty. But I don't want to win that fight and have it weaken the criminal justice system and not justify tough on crime policy by advocating for something like cost or like a hospital floor or stuff. Get it in the back door. We don't need to get it in the back door. We need to get it down in the full light of day in the public, and it needs to be the first step on the road to abolishing prison.
I do have a lot on the list, and I'm not going to be able to get to everybody, but we'll get in a few more folks before the speakers wrap up. So, Jack, and then the person in the black t-shirt. Yeah. Go ahead, Jack.
No thinking, no knowledge. So I just want to share some.
This is William Miller, right? This man really opened my life to a lot. George Jackson, Shady, Geronimo Pratt, Nelson Mandela, you know, just the list goes on and on. But this man is really, I just, it's like reading the book, like him talking to me. The man's coming tearful. But this man, here we are, we have freedom, we can see the light. This man, we have doctors, we have opportunities that he does, but this man is still one of the greatest men that ever lived to me.
Start to wrap up.
Okay, but this is what he said. He said, former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Warren Burger, has described our legal professional as sick. In Burger's view, the U.S. legal profession is marked by incompetence, lack of training, misconduct, and bad manners. Contemptuous, bludgeoning, no practice, and bad ethics can be observed in our courthouse all over the country every day. If you ever just stop in court and just ever go in court, this is mind blowing to me. I went to court and my son had to go to court. And the judge, every it was black or brown, every time they tried to speak, the judge would tell them, no, I don't want to hear it right now. But then when it came to the white gentleman, he was like, the white man went to court, well, what did he do? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm gonna grant you bail and you make sure you come back. Black and brown young man, yeah. He was shut up. Yeah. I don't want to hear it. You get a lawyer. Mm. A what? A plumbing pretender?
Mm-hmm. No.
Watch that.
I'm sorry. Right? I mean, it's just a setup. I mean, if you got money, you'll get away with things. If you got a public defender, I mean, I have many friends that have dealt with public. A lot of young men are in jail because of public defenders.
I was in private practice for four years.
Respect the chair.
Excuse me. We got a lot of folks that want to chime in. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jeff.
Okay. You there, and then Danielle. Go ahead.
All right. First of all, I just want to cover two very small points here. And the first one, I'm addressing the racism within our judicial system. I personally can attest to that because my father is not only a cop, he is a Nazi. You guys think I'm kidding. Basically, he would, when I lived with him, he would come home every day talking this crap. And aside from all the racist bullshit that he would say, he'd actually say a few things about the judicial system that actually meant something that would, of course, need some alter. One of which being that near the end of the month, the cops really have to press for a quota they need in terms of ticketing. And that's a lot of the times when you have to be careful when you're speeding on the freeway, even if you're just like 10 miles over the speed limit, the cop will pull you over, will not listen to you, and will give you a ticket at the end of the month. And other than that, of course, we all know that they go and they start beating innocent people just because of their race. So that's one thing to attest to from that. And my second point and my last point is that people today tend to get this idea from, I don't know if it's modern media or I don't know if it's conservatism itself, but they tend to think that we're more civilized just because it's 200 years from flogging, from hailing people, so to speak. And what I'd like to say to that in terms of irony is a quote from Valkyrie. A Nazi commander stated that in ancient Greece they used to kill people for delivering a drill more than once and it all being just drill, not actual legitimate call for service. And the last statement he makes is that, well, you better thank the heavens that we were civilized in that. Irony there. And basically with the whole irony notion is that that same thing could be applied to our society. They're using their terms of irony, trying to put our fellow workers into the jail systems, but they should be the ones in 25-1.
Mm-hmm. Danielle's next. Go ahead, Danielle.
Crystal and some others have mentioned how we fight the criminal justice system is really important. And I just want to underscore that point. Some people have mentioned that they are active with a group called the Campaign to End the Death Penalty. And I actually kind of disagree with what you mentioned about that fighting the death penalty is somehow this, you know, anomaly that's not connected up with the rest of the injustice system. I think that if we dealt a blow to the death penalty, that would be a huge, huge win, and, you know, give confidence to take on, you know, other things like the three strikes law and other sentencing. And there's another, you know, way in which we fight in the campaign to end the death penalty that other groups disagree with, and that's taking up individual struggles, whether that be Stanton V. Williams, Kevin Cooper, Troy Davis. And recently there's a struggle going on in LA that, you know, we're going to get involved in, that I wanted to let people know about if people haven't heard of it. His name is Alex Sanchez, and this just shows you how, you know, politically motivated our system is. He's a internationally known gang interventionist and, you know, peacemaker, and he's being charged with federal crimes on racketeering and murder and anything they can possibly think of to charge him with. And they recently denied him bail, saying that he was a risk to the community, which is absolutely absurd. So I just want to let people know that, like, you know, we're going to be working to take up that fight. And I think it's important to take up those individual fights because it puts a human face to this ugly system that, you know, destroys people's lives and families.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we just have time for one more person, and she's going to speak about how we can support the campaign to end the death penalty's work, and then we'll give the speakers a time to wrap up. Is it Mer?
Mer.
Yes, hi.
Go ahead.
I'm an activist for the campaign to end the death penalty, which is really unique among, you know, like this is what everyone was saying, among anti-death penalty, anti-prison organizations, because we're a radical organization that really sees our role as fighting racism and fighting against class inequality, and, you know, we do work that simply just, you know, isn't done and needs to be done, you know, broadly among the left, and we have a perspective on how to take down the death penalty, like Dana was saying, in a way that actually weakens the rest of the criminal system, that understands the role that fighting against the death penalty can play in building civil rights struggle in any racism in this country. And unfortunately, unlike many other nonprofits out there, we are small, we struggle every single year in order to survive, and the realities of this economic crisis is that the foundations that see that our work is important are getting throttled, and, you know, and we're bearing the brunt of that. And so I understand that there are a lot of pinches for money in your lives because you are lefties, and lefties never have enough money. But please, 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 when look at this form here. For the price of a beer every month for the campaign, you can get our literature in the hands of inmates for, you know, for, I give $50 a month because it's, you know, it's an organization that I really believe in. But the lowest credit card charge that we can make is $5. And so if that's not a burden, I really think that what this means as far as the role that we managed to play in the anti-prison movement, if you go down the list of people whose executions have been stopped, Ken Foster, Troy Davis, Kevin Cooper, I mean, all of the big names, and Stanton Williams, whose murder was an absolute travesty. Those are men that we worked closely with for years, and that's the work we do. So we have a fantastic relationship with, you know, death penalty and death row inmates in this country. And, you know, please think about joining. And if you become a new sustainer, we've got a free book from me and for you on the campaign table. So thanks.
Thank you very much. Awesome discussion. Before they wrap up, I just have some important announcements I need to go over, but starting with an announcement from Celeste.
Hi, I'm from Art for Democratic Society with Steve, and we're organizing an art show in October at Rock, Paper, Scissors Gallery, Collective Gallery in Oakland. I'm sorry?
With the
campaign there. It's getting to that. It's going to feature the work of three incarcerated artists. It's called The Human Face of Death Row. It's Kevin Cooper, James Anderson, and Eddie Vargas. So please come out and buy some art and support the end of the death penalty. Thanks.
Thank you.